Good morning, Alaska, and welcome to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. Well, ketamine was approved for the treatment of resistant depression in 2019 and has quickly become a growing treatment option for this challenging form of depression. Along with ketamine, MDMA-assisted therapy is now in the approval stage with the FDA. Despite the current buzz around psychedelic-assisted therapy, many questions remain. How safe are these drugs? What are the side effects? Are they effective at treating depression, PTSD, or even addiction? And who is a candidate? Well, in today's program, this is your chance to ask any questions you might have about these emerging treatment options for mental health disorders. Joining us for today's conversation is psychiatrist Dr. Richard Holt. Dr. Holt is joining us from Juneau, where he is the medical director for behavioral health services with the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SERCH. Welcome to the program, Dr. Holt. I appreciate you taking the time to join us today.
Good morning, Prentice. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, this program kind of like emerged in my brain from, like many of my programs do, from my practice and the what my clients are telling me and asking me. And this one, I'm getting a lot of questions about ketamine, psilocybin, microdosing, all those sorts of those questions that I cannot answer. And so I thought I would bring in somebody who knows quite a bit about this subject. And from our time as friends and from our conversations on the program before, I know that this is something you're pretty passionate about. So if you can, before I do that, let me, I need to give folks ways to reach us, because we do promote listener participation and would love for you to give us a call with your questions or comments today. Dr. Holt is a great resource if you want some information on this. In Anchorage, our local phone number is 907-550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, you can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. Spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. This is your chance to ask the experts, so let's not save all the questions for the end, and hopefully we can get you on the air. All right, Dr. Holt, can you just start us off by giving us a little bit about your background, what you're doing at SERCH, and how you got interested in the area of psychedelics and their use in therapy?
Happily. And I'll try to be brief, because I imagine we have a lot of ground and we'll have a lot of questions today. So I'm a psychiatrist. That means I'm a medical doctor with subspecialty training in psychiatric medicine. I've been practicing close to a couple decades now, and have been with SERCH for the last couple of years. And, you know, in addition to my clinical interests, I do have some training in functional neuroimaging and brain stimulation. And I think, you know, in general, my interest in kind of psychedelics just spurs from a larger interest in how consciousness is formed. You know, why is it that there is something that it is to be Prentice? You know, what is it that makes that unique experience? And then how do we then kind of peer into the minds of others and try to understand those? So why consciousness, and then why all the different varieties of it? So if you're interested in that at all as a researcher or as a clinician, you can't help but stumble into the space where these types of compounds have played an important historical role and are kind of coming back into the fold for clinical use.
Yeah, and I think that's probably the next question I have, or the next area I want to explore a little bit, is some of the history. This stuff, I mean, plant medicine has been used for, you know, since beginning of time in indigenous cultures to expand the mind, to explore, to go on sacred journeys and spiritual journeys. So this is not a new idea, and there was a lot of research in the 60s and even before. So I'd like for you to sort of maybe give us a quick broad brushstroke of you know, how this research started, why it got shelved, and why it's starting to come back now. What's the new awakening about, I guess?
Yeah, that again, essentially what you've talked about is covered largely in Michael Pollan's great book, How to Change Your Mind, and certainly could cover 10 hours of our time. But in brief, it's really hard to define when exactly, you know, things leaped from plant medicine to kind of pharmaceutical medicine. I mean, organic chemistry, it's not surprising that plants and fungi have co-evolved along with other living organisms, insects, primates, so that there are often chemicals that these things produce that produce effects at the cellular level, and some of those cells are going to be neurons. And so, you know, I think when we began in the 20th century to be able to tinker with compounds in the lab, we were able to synthesize some of these things. And so, you know, I think classically we think of the 50s and 60s especially as a time when we were able to find some of these entheogens out in the wild, replicate them in the lab, and then interestingly, they were really made widely available by the pharmaceutical companies, realized that these were very powerful, but didn't really know exactly what to do with them. So they were pretty much, you know, given to doctors, you know, pretty liberally throughout the 50s and 60s, you know, in an effort to figure out where they could best be used. And then as kind of the late 60s and 70s wore on, you know, there was definitely a blowback or a backlash to some of the counterculture of the 1960s and how these substances were being used in that. And I think that's, you know, when you start to see a more prohibition based and these things are moved out of the realm of things that we can do research on and explore with clinically, and then moved on to kind of that dreaded Schedule One of the DEA, where we can't actually, not only can't we not use them, we can't even do research on them in the federal funds. And so so that really put a chill on research for a long time. And then, you know, you start to see the kind of rebirth of that probably a two decades, you know, ago. Ketamine was definitely a part of that. I think the first double-blind randomized control trial for ketamine in depression was published in around 2000. So we're you know, so okay. and that was also in the growing body of research. I think of the Roland Griffiths work at Johns Hopkins, and keeping, you know, around that same time starting to work with psilocybin again, and then MDMA about that same time, perhaps even sooner. Although MDMA was the last one to come off, you know, to kind of enter that dreaded scheduling. I think it was early 80s that was actually still being used clinically or still illegal until the early 80s. And I know MAPS, the kind of organization that's working to get that back through FDA approval, has been around for decades as well.
And what does MAPS stand for?
It's the, I think, Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies.
Okay.
So, it's out of San Jose, California, I believe. Yep.
All right. So these, you know, once the government made the war on drugs really sort of crushed all of that and the criminalization, and then we moved into that whole time of locking people up when they had addictions and not really supporting folks who had that. And there's been, you know, a shift, I think, in consciousness as far as like how criminalizing addiction and these drugs, you know, I mean, they're known as many of them, mushrooms, MDMA, like they're abused as party drugs. Can you talk about like the difference between the use in a clinical trial, I mean, a clinical sort of setting where you're getting treatment for this versus, you know, the, I don't know, the rave or the, you know, dance all night and rage?
Yeah, the analogy I would use here is that we do already work with things that are highly psychoactive and do have potential risks, and we regulate them closely. Things like narcotic pain relievers, benzodiazepines, which are very powerful, yeah. Anxiety medications, and amphetamine derivatives that we use to treat ADHD and other things, you know, are powerfully psychoactive, tightly regulated, and we try to use them judiciously and safely because each has the potential for harm, or including abuse and dependence, if not managed, you know, carefully. And I think that goes to the distinction between carefully managing and outright prohibition. And so, and I think the common thread here is also that dose makes a big difference. Dose and not just dose, but the mindset and the setting in which you're using these things. And so, you know, we are more than simply bags of chemicals to be manipulated. We have journeys and stories and our own kind of cognitive schema and rationale for kind of being and doing the things we do. And so, you know, anything that changes your consciousness certainly can be used to, I suppose, for lack of a better term, just to have fun, if that's kind of your journey. But I think that is distinctly different from kind of looking at, you know, a carefully orchestrated therapeutic alliance in which you are specifically looking at something that you'd like to change because it's causing you distress or dysfunction. And then, you know, working with someone on using any of the substances I've mentioned, you know, to help you recover from those things. I know, you know, a lot of work is being done on trauma, you know, treatment-resistant depression, and we'll talk about those things, I think, in more depth. And I think, you know, God is in the details here. It's looking at exactly precisely how we're using these things, at what doses and in what contexts, that, you know, tells us exactly what we're doing with them.
I think you make a really good point, and which brings up another question for me. Like, ketamine, MDMA, psilocybin, you know, these sorts of drugs that are more associated with, you know, parties or, you know, kids using them for recreational use. But they're also using Xanax consistently. It's a big problem that shows up in my, you know, bars. They're using Oxy and, you know, Adderall and all these sort of stimulants as not as prescribed. What is the difference, and why is there, I guess, a stigma associated with some of these MDMA and ketamine and mushrooms? Or is there a stigma associated with it? How are they different than Seroquel and Zyprexa and Adderall and some of these drugs that are just sort of everyday mainstream things that people take without really thinking about it?
Yeah, well, my hope is that they are thinking about it. First of all, I think one of the things that I do with any patient I'm working with is I make sure that we do have a careful discussion of, you know, the indications, risk benefits, what this, and I generally, I don't like to talk about kind of diagnoses per se, because I think when you use the word depression or anxiety, it can mean so many different things for so many different people. And so I try to set expectations around their experience. What will you experience if you are taking an antidepressant medication, you know, for that, there's a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, what would you expect to experience based on what we know about your current symptoms, and how much time will that take, you know, and what would it look like? Because it's not a very much use to say, you'll just be undepressed. I mean, you know, you might experience greater resilience, greater distress tolerance, less irritability, things like better sleep and appetite. We want to know exactly what your experience is going to be like on those things. And I think kind of that's the same way we should talk about, you know, if and when these drugs, you know, kind of pass through the very rigorous FDA approval, you know, they will be subject to tight controls. And we'll talk a little more about ketamine, I imagine, in a moment. It is subject to a what's called a REMS program, a risk evaluation and mitigation strategy. So it's a tightly controlled substance. You're required to have a really robust set of procedures in place if you're doing it according to the FDA standards.
Yeah, what you're talking about is being, excuse me, an informed consumer. Really understanding what you're taking, why you're taking it, what the purpose is, what you hope it will do, and then really evaluating that along the way. I have a lot of clients that don't really pay much attention, and then the psychiatrist asks them, well, how's your mood been? Is it, well, I don't know. Maybe it's better, maybe it's worse, but really understanding what you're taking, why you're taking it, and for what purpose. So that, and that's true with any drug.
Yeah, I think these things are, I mean, that therapeutic workspace is a chance to, the medications fit into a larger journey into discovering how we tick, you know, what motivates me, what are my models, what holds those in place, what causes me to resist change. And that really should have a learning component. It should be a really learning and growth, not just kind of, you know, here, take this and you'll feel better. I don't think that's a useful therapeutic conversation. What's going on and why things are better, why things are worse is really an important and broader conversation. And that's what distinguishes recreational use from medicinal use. You know, whether that's a shaman doing an ayahuasca ceremony or being in the medical clinic, you know, working with someone and consulting, whether using ketamine treatment would be appropriate for them.
All right. Well, let's jump right into ketamine. And can you talk about ketamine? It's only been, you said, approved since 2019. Can you talk about what it's approved for and what somebody could, who would go and seek this out and why?
Yeah. So ketamine was approved for treatment-resistant depression. And we don't actually have a defined kind of specific definition of what that means. But in general, if someone has failed two adequate trials of an antidepressant medication, they would potentially be a candidate for intranasal esketamine, which is the only FDA-approved form of ketamine. And I just want to start from the outset and say, of all the things we're going to be talking about today, really the only thing that is FDA approved at this point of all of those, tantalizing, treatments is intranasal esketamine. And that was approved for that treatment-resistant depression that I just discussed in 2018. And then again, it received additional approval, I believe, in 2020 for acute suicidality in adults. And that is another thing that it does help with. And we can talk a little bit about its history and why it maybe does that, if you're interested.
For sure. I do want to, is ketamine being delivered in other ways in clinics around the country or in Alaska besides the approved nasal spray?
Yes. And again, the caveat being here, all of this is not FDA approved, but certainly being used. I think there's a broad use of, so IV ketamine, intravenous ketamine was the first, I think, when we were, and part of it's understanding that ketamine is not a new compound. It's really been around since the 60s. So, and so we have a lot of familiarity with it. It's not just used in this setting. In fact, this is probably the setting we're talking about today is that it's the one it's least commonly used in. It's used, for deep sedation, like in critical care settings. It's used for pain treatment. So it has excellent sort of pain attenuation properties. And so it's used a lot in surgery, critical care settings, emergency departments, even certain first responders do use it. So we kind of know a lot about it. Having it, the first IV use of it was just trying to get the dose right. And this was again, back in the 90s, trying to figure out what allowed you to kind of achieve a state where someone could have an experience that wasn't completely dissociative or unconscious, because how ketamine works is it blocks a particular glutamate receptor, and glutamate is the neurotransmitter in the brain, which is the primary activating neurotransmitter in the brain. So when neurons want to talk to each other in sort of an activating sort of way, they use glutamate, and there's one specific receptor that ketamine blocks, the N-methyl-D-aspartate or NMDA receptor. And by reducing that excitation, depending on how broadly it does that, really determines its effects. And so for our particular purposes, the level of blockade we want from the ketamine is just enough to allow for some plasticity, because that NMDA receptor is really involved in plasticity, or the ability of neurons to change the way in which they speak to one another. So in these processes like learning and memory, we could think of trauma, for example, as an aberrant form of learning. You have right. learned that the world is unpredictable in a very unsafe way. And because of that trauma, it can be very difficult to relinquish that model of unsafety. And so in working with a therapist, using one of these medications, you would do the therapy first and then kind of use the setting of the treatment that lasts only an hour for the intravenous or the 2 hours for the other forms. And then you would kind of debrief afterwards. So you do a lot of processing before the experience itself would be kind of pretty low stimulus. You really don't do too much work in that space, and then you process it afterwards. But what you really want to have happen as an outset is that you want some openness or some flexibility into old and kind of tired models of that have supported kind of illness or dysfunction to kind of be more open and amenable to change.
Yeah, because you're talking about rigid, long-term memories that are stored deep in our brains. That's the trauma response that we see. Like if we have a smell or an association or something, and we go into that state of, you know, fight or flight or panic, that anxiety state. And those things have been like deeply ingrained in our brains from often early childhood. And so the idea is that ketamine will sort of loosen up those, or you can rework some of those memories or your reactivity to it.
There is this kind of this idea that there is cognition or these models of that we hold in place of kind of what our reality is. And then there's these kind of brackets around them that are called metacognition that says, okay, how much evidence am I required before I change my view as a traumatized person that the world is unpredictable, unsafe? Because of course the consequences of letting that belief go too soon in an unsafe environment would be catastrophic. And so what that leads to is people who feel unsafe, even when their sensory environment gives them no kind of information to suggest that they are. And so by using the kind of substances to kind of not, again, this is in the context of carefully orchestrated therapy, to kind of prepare a person, and then you put them in that space. And I want to be clear, those spaces aren't always comfortable. The treatments themselves, whether it be ketamine, MDMA, or psilocybin, can be very unpleasant experiences, and really, you know, people need to know that going in, is that they may have a difficult experience, and that does not mean that's not a therapeutic experience. People definitely, you know, with ketamine have described having kind of death or near death experiences, out of body experiences, very troubling hallucinations, sensory distortions, like, you know, they feel floating or stretching or just strange things that can be very unsettling. And really the role of the person supporting them through that, the professional supporting them through that, isn't to try to do any interpretation or discussion in that space, just to reassure them, it's okay, stay with it,
right,
and keep going.
All right, we are past our first break. So if you're just tuning in, my guest today is psychiatrist Dr. Richard Holt. We are discussing the emerging field of psychedelic-assisted therapy to treat mental health conditions. If you have a question for Dr. Holt or a comment about today's topic or a story you'd like to share, if you've gone through this process, please feel free to give us a call or send us an email. In Anchorage, we can be reached at 907-550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue with more of our conversation with Dr. Richard Holt. I'm Prentice Pemberton. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line One on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've got Medicaid, make sure Medicaid has got you too by keeping your contact information up to date. Visit MedicaidRenewals.alaska.gov to use the new online form to quickly update your contact information without waiting. A current mailing address, phone number, and email address is needed to avoid delays in healthcare coverage. Plan to stay covered by visiting MedicaidRenewals.alaska.gov for information and resources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I am your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in today, my guest is psychiatrist Dr. Richard Holt. We are discussing the emerging field of psychedelic-assisted therapy in the treatment of mental health conditions. If you have a question for Dr. Holt, a comment about today's topic, or anything you'd like to share, please don't hesitate to give us a call or send us an email. Our Anchorage phone number is 907-550-8433. Outside of Anchorage, you can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. 952, and you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, Dr. Holt, we were discussing the ketamine treatment process, and I'd like to for you to go into a little bit more detail. Like, if someone was going to go in for or seek out ketamine treatment, like, what would they expect as far, what could they expect, and why is it not just like taking you know, some mushrooms and having a little trip? I mean, there's a whole process, and it's not a magic bullet, right?
Yes, and in frank response to your question, I think that many people seeking these types of treatments at this point in our history experience frustration, because we currently do not have the clinical infrastructure in place to support what is essentially a new paradigm,
right,
in the treatment of these illnesses. You know, we have built a lot of infrastructure in the medical side around the 15-minute med check, or this kind of, you know, or these medications that we kind of titrate and then work with, you know, over regular visits over months and months. But in fact, that's quite different from what is going to be on offer with these treatments, ketamine and MDMA, but also psilocybin that we've discussed and others that emerge in that same paradigm, is that, you know, the work here would be, you know, working in tandem with your therapist and then making the decision, you know, to go into this specific space to complete the work that you had started there. And so that takes time. So that, you know, it currently, you know, I know in our system, we just don't have, you know, we have approval, we're a site, we can do, you know, it's on our formulary, the intranasal, but the rigorous requirements to have the spaces and which are fully appropriate just are so labor and cost intensive that it's taking us time to build them appropriately and intentionally. So for our purposes, we're building a brand new purpose-built clinic here in Juneau that will include a specific space for this type of therapy. And we've already got the procedures in place, you know, so we're already kind of, you know, getting things aligned so that when we hop into that new space, you know, within the next year, we'll have that infrastructure and team in place. But it's a lot of work to build it, which I think it's both proper to build it that way, but I also think there's not an option. The regulatory kind of structures are such that if we're going to do it, you know, inside an FDA and kind of a clinical infrastructure that's organizational in nature, that, you know, I want to be clear, I'm coming from the perspective of a medical doctor and a scientist, not a shaman. So that's the perspective in which I have to build the clinical infrastructure. And I want to be clear, I'm not saying that's the only way to do this. It's just the only way that I can do them. So with folks. And so that requires a lot of heavy lifting. In the meantime, it's really important. You know, I do realize that there are just people out there in the world who are outstripping us on that. They're, you know, because they have a lot more freedom to kind of explore those spaces just outside of kind of the regular medical, you know, structure. And I know that certainly is going on. I know that, you know, a lot of people are getting ketamine sublingually and orally and other ways out there. And I just, you know, it's sort of gray market. So at this point, so it's not something, you know, I know, you know, kind of, I only know through secondhand sources. I'm not really directly involved in any of that.
Well, I do. One of the reasons I wanted to have you on is because while you are a medical doctor, I've known you long enough to know that you do have a little bit of shaman in you. Like, there is a spiritual piece and a piece that you take this sort of journey seriously and for your patients and for the people. And so, like, I'm hearing stories and you know, we'll probably reach out to some of the local clinics who are doing it, but I don't have any details, but from my clients who are telling me that, you know, they're going in and they're getting ketamine and then they're just kind of hanging out and listen to some music and then they go home. That does not seem to be the type of process that you're talking about, where there is a lot of talk building up and then a follow through and a, you know, it almost seems like you need a clinician either on the team or like participating in that process, a therapist. That seems like an important piece.
Yes, for our purposes, absolutely yes. So, you know, someone be working in a specific modality, although, you know, they're not widely adopted because it's still early days. There is, for example, you know, an internal family systems approach, the specific type of therapy that uses that paradigm to explore kind of before you go into a ketamine treatment. And so, you know, we have internal family systems therapists to be working with someone. They would then kind of collaborate with the prescribing psychiatrist on this particular client. So there would be this collaboration, and then after the treatment, you know, that person would continue to work in that space, hopefully more productively. And one of the things, you know, it is, you know, these spaces are powerful. I guess I'll speak a little bit shamanistically, you know, or at least philosophically in this space, is that one of the powerful things they offer is ego dissolution, this idea of sort of feeling trapped in kind of your own kind of the way you ought to be rather than the way you could be. And I certainly think that's certainly a common theme that has philosophical and spiritual kind of dimensions. It's been explored, you know, not only most recently by science, but of course that's well tread ground, you know, for philosophy and religion. And so it's just, you know, understanding how we are kind of crosswalking ideas like, you know, kind of ego dissolution with what we know about, you know, neural networks, such as the default mode network and things like that, and trying to find not necessarily a way to map them exactly on top of one another, but to be able to kind of not imprison ourselves in strictly one type of language to talk about these experiences. Because I think that also can, you know, I love to talk kind of neural networks and things like that and kind of computational neuroscience language, but that's not the language many of my patients speak. And so it's a very little use for me to engage them strictly in that area. And so the way they will understand it is part of their spiritual journey. And that's perfectly okay. That's where I meet them.
Okay, let's go to the phones. We have our first caller who's been on hold for a little bit. Sam, you're on line one. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a veteran. I struggle with depression. I've had a lot of trauma throughout my years, not necessarily combat trauma. I'm also pretty isolated. I very much struggle to socialize. And I've tried therapy through the VA. I've tried other types. I've tried your standard antidepressants. I don't really feel like any of that has been helpful. And also, like, the help that I've been getting, you know, the therapy that I've been getting through the VA and from, like, you know, just traditional sources of therapy, you know, really hasn't been all that helpful to me throughout the years, because, like, I have been working on myself, you know, for my entire adult life. I really want to try something new and radical. I really need somebody to, like, you know, sit down and work with me in a form, you know, in some way that'll help me learn how to, like, trust people. And I have been hearing a lot about psychedelic treatments. I just cannot seem to find anywhere where I can, you know, receive psychedelic treatments. I've heard the VA is experimenting with psychedelic treatments in Oregon, but that doesn't seem to be the case here in Alaska. Is there anywhere that you can talk, you know, tell me where to go to find these kinds of treatments, please?
All right, Sam, thank you for that call. I think that's exactly the kind of call we're looking for. And I appreciate you calling in. Dr. Holt, you have an answer for Sam?
I don't, you know, work for the VA, but I actually, you know, have conversations with folks inside the VA across the country. And certainly there are some small scale projects going on using psychedelic assisted therapy for veterans with trauma. And in fact, much of the work for MDMA in particular, because I'm going to shift gears to talk about that rather than ketamine in this space, is that a lot of that work was originally done in veterans who had, you know, symptom clusters very similar to what Sam describes. Again, you know, without knowing any further detail, I can't recommend or not recommend anything, but broadly speaking, that notion that veterans with a certain type of trauma that leads them to feel like they can't engage with or trust the world was certainly a lot of the work that inspired Mike Midhoffer, who's a doctor who for decades ago was working in exactly that space with veterans on the East Coast. And I know that's one of that maps, that group of folks who are working on kind of getting MDMA, FDA approved trauma and trauma kind of for veterans is one of their interests. And so I wish I could direct Sam to a particular VA, but I think the larger urban ones, and I don't believe it's available here in Alaska at all through the VA. So that would mean engaging in kind of discussions with one of the other large urban VA centers that is conducting either research or small trials on one of those substances, one of those treatments.
Now, is ketamine is not what the approach for PTSD or trauma? Is that more of the MDMA realm, or are they using ketamine for that? What is ketamine used to treat right now? Is it just the treatment resistant depression?
Well, I mean, out in the world, ketamine's used to treat everything in a lot of ways, but I want to make sure that, you know, the FDA approver really hews towards treatment resistant depression. And so so that's kind of and again, that for in emergency settings, it can be used for acute suicidality. Those are both, so it tends to hew towards that model of learned helplessness that comes with chronic depression, and especially if it contains a component of anxious distress. I think that, although I won't get into the particular details of how it works kind of both cortically and subcortically, ketamine seems to set up very nicely for particularly depressive illnesses with that profoundly kind of distressed kind of aspect. Whereas, you know, MDMA is being looked at specifically for FDA approval for PTSD. Having said that, I mean, I think in the world, all of these things, anything we're talking about is being investigated for substance use disorders. I think, how shall I say this? The first indication that's sought and achieved doesn't necessarily fully encompass the breadth of treatment options that folks would have once the clinical supporting infrastructure and the FDA-approved forms of these kind of compounds are, you know, completed. But it's a tough time. I want to acknowledge that what Sam is going through is right. Kind of where we are in the world right now. We're kind of waiting at the threshold of something very big. And I think that's also very important that we as psychiatrists really work hard to stay abreast of what's going on, you know, in these developments and be prepared to, you know, change and support that infrastructure. I think that as long as we're all rowing together kind of to try to get it in place, it will fall into place. But it's just an agonizing time right now, I think, because I think there's a lot of knowledge out there. If you look at the evidence-based literature out there, it's grown by leaps and bounds. I mean, there were just so few articles. There are so few, you know, high-quality research articles and studies. Now there are dozens upon dozens of them for all of these. And so they really are accumulating just huge amounts of data in support of their use, you know, and that they're largely not more unsafe than things we currently use. So I think we're just kind of waiting for the bureaucratic end. And then once that is achieved, again, I think the biggest change and the biggest structural hurdle we have is that the infrastructure of how we run our clinics and how we integrate our healthcare systems is just going to have to change.
You described it yesterday when we were talking. You described it as kind of a wild, wild west time, where clinics are opening and they're, you know, there's not a lot of really like formal procedural things set in place, and people are just kind of like setting up shop, and then they'll close down. I mean, it's sort of in that infancy stage, right?
Yes, and it's concerning because I really think for those who have spent decades really championing the reintroduction of these treatments, they've been so careful and so measured in you know, emphasizing how important the mindset and the work going into that space, how important the appropriate setting and timing of the treatment is, and then the aftercare, how important that is. And in some ways it's a little bit unfortunate that ketamine was the first one out, because ketamine is a short treatment. You know, you can be in and out. It kind of sets itself up for that kind of exploitation because it's a quick in and out treatment, you know, unlike MDMA, which is like 6 to 8 hours, and psilocybin, which is again about that same. You know, you can set up a center that moves people through quickly and profitably. And you can also guarantee a fairly large, once you've mastered the art of kind of figuring out how to give the infusions or the intranasal, people will feel better. I mean, there is almost invariably kind of after the treatment, a period lasting from days to weeks of well-being. that's the entire point. You've got to do something with it. You know, you can't, I mean, right. I think lurching from ketamine treatment to ketamine treatment was never, you know, what was intended. It was meant to be kind of either one or a very short series of treatments at most. And then, you know, kind of that we would leverage that experience into change that would be more lasting than just needing more treatment a few weeks later.
Which is not different, really, than the psychiatric medications we've had around for 40, 50 years, is that, you know, that idea of that it has to be in conjunction with some additional work. It's not, as you said, a magic bullet. It doesn't just fix things. Like, there needs to be deeper work going on. Exercise, I mean, it's like all that stuff is important and vital in recovery from these sort of long-term mental health conditions.
Yeah, and it's something else you and I were talking about is that, you know, a lot of the way we live our lives is a kind of medicine. So the integration, I think, absolutely, kind of the estrangement of the what people are doing psychotherapeutically and what they're doing with medications, we really need to avoid that. There needs to be a sense that those things aren't detached. You know, that medications are used best in the context of, you know, what's going on with that, having a better understanding of that person's inner mental landscape and their journey. And that takes time and effort and vulnerability, you know, and may not be the most kind of cost effective way to run a business, but it is the best way to deliver care. And so we have to figure out a way to manage that of kind of keep giving the best care to our clients and keeping the lights on. That's always a challenge when you're kind of, you know, when you're in mental health. But the other thing is that, you know, these are not the only keys to the kingdom in terms of, you know, exercise. People do holotropic breath work, you know, kind of Wim Hof method, kind of, there's all kinds of different yogic practices. There's all kinds of ways to get to these that aren't necessarily happening in our clinics. And they all share the common thread of being very intentional.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the key ingredient is intentionality and doing it with a mindset of growth and as part in conjunction with lots of other activities of connection, of increasing your sense of belonging in the community. All those things are vital. All right. So if you're just tuning in, my guest today is psychiatrist Dr. Richard Holt. We are discussing the emerging field of psychedelic-assisted therapy to treat mental health conditions. If you have a question for Dr. Holt or a comment about today's topic, please don't hesitate to give us a call or send us an email. Our Anchorage phone number, we can be reached at 907-550-8433. If you're calling outside of Anchorage, our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Richard Holt. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on alaskapublic.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've got Medicaid, make sure Medicaid has got you too by keeping your contact information up to date. Visit medicaidrenewals.alaska.gov to use the new online form to quickly update your contact information without waiting. A current mailing address, phone number, and email address is needed to avoid delays in healthcare coverage. Plan to stay covered by visiting medicaidrenewals.alaska.gov for information and resources. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in late, my guest is psychiatrist Dr. Richard Holt. We are discussing the emerging field of psychedelic-assisted therapy to treat mental health conditions. If you have a question for Dr. Holt, comment about today's topic, please give us a call or send us an email. Our local number in Anchorage is 907-550-8433. Our toll-free line is 1-888-353-5752, and you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. If you are thinking about calling, do it in the next 5 minutes or so, because we're rapidly approaching the time when I can't take any more calls. So, just pick up the phone and give us a call, and Dr. Holt can take it. I want to get back to Sam for a second. And if somebody is wanting to get help and wanting to explore this more, Dr. Holt, do you know of who they can call? What's the first step to reaching out to finding a clinic? I know there's a couple of clinics in Anchorage, but what would someone do if they're just, yeah, I mean, Sam sounds like a perfect candidate. He's done lots of work. He's tried lots of things. He's done the typical meds, like he's gone through, and he's really struggling to get some help.
Yeah, currently I think there are two routes to that. And one is, you know, being part of a large system like the IHS, like we are here at Search, or like the VA system, or a big one, you know, like Kaiser Permanente, or I think in Alaska, we have Providence. You know, if you're affiliated, if you're a patient of one of those, they certainly would be having some kind of your, if you're a psychiatrist or your therapist were part of that, one of those larger groups, then they would be connected to a much larger system that could provide answers to those questions. And again, they may be frustrating. I know that we have a lot less capacity currently here at Search than we have need. You know, I know that we have to often, you know, be hyper selective, and we oftentimes just don't have the capacity to treat the people we need to. Now we're working on that, and we will catch up. It's all about that infrastructure. But in the meantime, again, there, I can't speak to it, but I know there's a whole gray market of folks that is springing up in the penumbra of that lack of readily available services through the larger systems. And while I know it's there, I don't know anything about it specifically, actually. And I certainly welcome conversations with any of those folks. I think that I don't think that anything they're doing is wrong. It's just not anything that I can touch as kind of part of the system I'm with and in my current role. But I do think that, you know, that definitely does exist and is probably a pathway for folks right now. I do have some concerns that again, like the kind of ketamine treatment as it's playing out kind of in the lower 48. There's the difference between having a scrupulous and unscrupulous, or someone who's not truly as experienced as they claim to be. So into that space, you know, kind of caveat emptor, you know, buyer beware, you really don't know. And so that doesn't necessarily have all of the safety and training, you know, screening tools and kind of infrastructure that would guarantee you kind of like safety. But I know it exists, so I won't pretend it doesn't.
Yeah. Could somebody start with their family doctor and talk about ketamine, or their psychiatrist would probably have some answers? I know you can just Google it and you can find the clinics.
Yeah. So again, probably the short answer to your initial question is, yeah, talk to your doctor, and your doctor hopefully is at least affiliated or familiar with someone who can help you continue that conversation. I think that's probably the best starting point, is finding an advocate inside the existing system for you.
Yeah, and it looks like the MDMA treatments, like you would have to be part of a clinical trial at this point, right? Or some sort of research program.
Currently, yes. Yes, because it does not have FDA approval for that purpose. And so it's still Schedule I. And that's where it's different than, you know, ketamine. Ketamine has been FDA approved for a long time. We just used it for different things, whereas both MDMA and psilocybin really have to be rescheduled by the DEA in such a way that they can actually be prescribed. And certainly, you know, the DEA actually has a supply of, you know, controls the supply of these things. So if you're doing research on psilocybin, you're getting it from the feds.
Right. Okay, we have another caller that I want to get to. Jeanette in Anchorage, you have a question for Dr. Holt?
I do. I'm curious if there have been any studies done on psychedelics with CTE, even though I know CTE can't be properly diagnosed until after death.
Right.
But the spouses know, trust me.
Yeah, so Jeanette, That's a good question. And as far as I know, no. And so I'm just going to, for the audience, expand that a bit. So CTE is chronic traumatic encephalopathy. So it's essentially what someone, when they have multiple, you know, concussive or traumatic brain injuries over time. I think the famous case of this would be Junior Seau, the linebacker I think ended up suiciding. And it certainly is military veterans, those who play contact sports, have high rates of chronic traumatic encephalopathies. And they can be devastating for their mental health, for their cognition, for their relationships. I'm sure Jeanette has a much more intimate and detailed and broader understanding of what that actually is like for the people in those lives. And I can imagine it can't have been, it isn't easy. And so there isn't a lot. I don't know of any offhand, and there's probably some reasons for that. And I certainly have worked and do work with several folks with CTE. And one of the kind of salient features of working with someone with that particular, I really see that as a neurological, even though Jeanette's right, you can't really see what's going on in any real detailed way until you do a postmortem on the brain. But those sheer injuries and those the kind of the damage to the specific neurons themselves means that anything that I use, you know, kind of that has any at all psychoactive properties or potential psychoactive properties behaves very unpredictably. It's almost like the wiring has been scrambled in some ways. Those neuronal connections that kind of make up the kind of the weft and warp of that person's consciousness have been, you know, kind of forever changed by those kind of multiple insults to the brain. And so that means when I send something into that space, I really oftentimes have, you know, very little ability to predict how it's going to behave. So in essence, I'm not saying there isn't a space, but I imagine we'd be looking at like very low doses and very careful. You know, I don't imagine that's going to be among the first sought after, you know, FDA approved uses. But it sure sounds something worthwhile working in. And so it sounds another one to be excellent for the VA or people working with ex NFL players. Yeah. Certainly there's certainly, you know, research populations that would be good, you know, that are readily at hand for future investigation. So I'm going to, after that kind of lengthy way of saying I'm professing my ignorance, I will just profess my ignorance and say not that I'm aware of.
All right. But that's a great question. And thank you so much for the call. I do have an email that I want to read real quick. And it's somebody who says, I'm struggling mightily with this topic. A few years ago, my daughter turned 21. I gave her what I thought was good parental advice. Just because you can doesn't mean you should. Her response was, just because I shouldn't doesn't mean I can't. The comment is really about legalizing what were illicit drugs, has all sorts of societal risks. And when liberalization, making a potent drugs available for recreational use, how good is that for the average citizen or taxpayer? Is it good for families? I mean, this is a different kind of question, but I do often hear this, like legalization of marijuana, legalization of all these drugs. What are the benefits to, do you have any thoughts on the legalization versus non-legalization? I mean, there's all sorts of substances that, alcohol, sugar, nicotine, these things are getting our kids at a very early age. And we're not talking here today about legalizing all this stuff.
Yeah, I guess that's the first thing I would say is that there is a distinct difference between kind of legalizing something, which I do agree has a very complex societal implications. You alluded to the legalization of cannabinoids that has kind of taken place across the United States over the past decade. And, you know, it's been a bit of a mixed bag in some ways. But I want to distinguish that from bringing things that were excluded from careful scientific scrutiny and carefully overseen clinical use and bringing those back into the fold under careful medical supervision. I actually see that as wholly good because I really do think that, like other things that I prescribe, these things have significant risks and they must be managed in order to call yourself a responsible, you know, prescriber of these things or one who's going to utilize them, but we already do that. What I think was a bit of throwing the baby out with the bathwater is saying that, you know, kind of by moving them off of the schedules that we can kind of study or prescribe in any way, shape, or form, we've just kind of trapped ourselves in this cul-de-sac of decades of absolute lack of knowledge about these things. And right. so we've just find ourselves way behind. So I do think that kind of, because the fact is if they're not safe, they just won't be approved and won't be used. And that's why I also like the idea of, I really quite like, you know, going back to the kind of the way we're doing it here, is we are hewing strictly to the risk evaluation and management strategies set forth by the FDA, we're dotting the I's and crossing the T's, because that is the best evidence in terms of how to get both safety and efficacy. And that does at the front end mean reduced accessibility. I get that. But, right. We have to build on quality and then we'll build on volume.
You mentioned the side effects. I know the side effects to some of these psychotropic, really heavy dose medications, and some of them are very severe for some of the, the run of the mill standard psychiatric medications. How do the risks stack up with ketamine and MDMA compared to, Seroquels and the antipsychotics of the world, or some of these, the benzodiazepines?
Yeah. So like those things, the risks are formidable, real, and manageable. And so a lot of it has to do with dose, is that, ketamine at when it's dosed higher than the sub-anesthetic doses that we would be talking about here can be quite dangerous. We use ketamine in critical care, and people keep people under sedation. So some people really, have negative side effects from the uses surgically. Some people have really negative side effects when we use them for pain control. And when we are taking people out of long-term deep sedation from ketamine, it can be incredibly difficult. There are certain kind of, a literature suggesting that chronic heavy recreational use does cause lasting problems. And so, and those sentences that I said about ketamine, I could say about
right.
any of the prescribed substances, and that just goes to responsible use. Responsible prescribing and making sure that we are educating our patients, not just sort of in euphorically on the potential benefits, but also with due caution on the risks.
And we're running out of time, but I do want to ask, what does the early research indicate as to the effectiveness of ketamine on this intractable sort of treatment resistant depression? What are we seeing?
Great. It gets good results. I mean, that's incontrovertible. I mean, I think that, with the accurate, kind of patient selection, its results approach that of what was the gold standard for treatment resistant depression, which was electroconvulsive therapy,
right.
Which could be the topic of an entire another hour. But I think it approaches that level of, not quite, but that level of, for people who have failed multiple trials, it can be a game changer, and I can't give you exact numbers, but it's, it gives you a very good shot. So it's not an unreasonable expectation for the correctly chosen patient and with the correctly done kind of protocol, to expect a significant positive result, is the norm.
Okay. Who would, a lot of people can't just get this. So if somebody's interested, real quick, tell us what's the process. Do they got to get in with a psychiatrist and go from there?
Yes. I mean, any place who's doing it according to the kind of the FDA and DEA standards would have to be doing it according to, would have to be embedded in a medical setting. And so that would be talking to your doctor first and foremost, and expect a long wait. I think that's the big one. And I want to wrap here because I know we're running out of time. I always wish we had 2 hours when we do this, Prentiss.
All right. Well, thank you. And I want to thank my audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and my producer, Madeline Rose. For all of us at Line One, thanks for taking the time to join us today. Until next time, I'm Prentiss Pemberton. Have a great day, Alaska.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.